This podcast of Left, Right, and Center is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
The president's numbers plummet and Scooter Libby pleads not guilty. Bush names a new Supreme Court nominee and have the Democrats found their spine. Hello again and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, the civilized yet provocative antidote to the screaming talking heads that dominate political debate. I'm Robert Scheer, syndicated columnist based at the Los Angeles Times, sitting in for Matt Miller, who's away on assignment today. Arianna Huffington, editor of the political blog HuffingtonPost.com, joins me in our home studio representing a populist perspective. Also in our home studio is guest centrist Edward Lazarus, who served as a clerk to Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun and is the author of Closed Chambers and the Rise and Fall and Future of the Modern Supreme Court. Tony Blankley is in Moscow, so our guest on the right today is Dr. Daniel Gore, vice president of the Lexington Institute with a specialty in national defense strategies. The president's poll numbers are down, and on Thursday, Vice President Dick Cheney's former chief of staff, Louis Libby, resigned after being indicted last week. And on Thursday, his new defense team came out swinging with a not guilty plea to all five felony counts in the CIA leak case. Let's turn to former prosecutor Edward Lazarus and former softball competitor to Scooter Libby to weigh in first.
Well, Scooter's an excellent shortstop, I'll tell you that. But he's got real problems here. Today, the most interesting event was the fact that he's brought new counsel into his team, Ted Wells and Bill Jeffress, who are, I don't know how to describe it other than to say these are the serious heavy hitters, and they're going to have relationships back with Patrick Fitzgerald going back a long way. So they're people who can get along with Fitzgerald, talk to Fitzgerald, but if necessary, take the case to trial. So I think that signals that Scooter has woken up and realizes he's in deep trouble and he's brought in the absolute A-team.
You know, I mentioned that you played baseball with him. I mean, is he a nice guy? Is he smart? Does he know his law? Did you guys argue about politics?
I've always liked Scooter. I've known him a long, long time. He's a delightful person. You know, what can I say? But that the indictment is very strong against him. I know a lot of people who like him who read the indictment and went, oh, my God, how could somebody that bright basically go in front of a grand jury and say things that so many people can contradict categorically. That's trouble.
But before I get our other guests in, let me just ask you, John Dean today had a column in which he said the only reason this makes sense, what Libby's done, is he's the firewall protecting Cheney, and that the prosecutor's trying to flip Scooter Libby. You're a former prosecutor. Do you think that's plausible?
I think it's very plausible. That's the standard operating procedure for most prosecutors, is that you look for someone who you can readily indict. And then you hope that they give you information that leads to other indictments if you believe other kinds of wrongdoing have gone on here. Whether Fitzgerald really thinks Cheney is guilty or something or not, I can't say, but it would be standard operating procedure to put the pressure on Scooter Libby and find out.
Let me turn to our guest on the right, Dr. Daniel Gore. You also know Scooter Libby. You worked with him in the Defense Department in the first Bush administration and Bush's father's administration. How does a Libby plea strike you, and do you think there's more to come, and do you think Cheney's at risk?
Well, as somebody who worked with Scooter, I'm really surprised that he appears from the indictment to have been so dumb in the way he went about this. Whether it's true or not, or whether there's anything behind it, Scooter's a consummate bureaucrat, consummate lawyer. He's the kind of guy who measures the margins on the papers that you send in to him before he sends them up to the boss. And so for him to be this clumsy about it is particularly surprising, I think, to anybody who knows him.
Let me ask you, though, do you think there's going to be closure on this, as some Republicans are hoping, and, okay, Scooter Libby is out there and he'll take his lumps and postpone this until after the midterm election and there won't be any more damage, Rove is off the hook, Cheney will be protected, or are you fearful or do you anticipate that this will go further?
I don't think so. In fact, if you look at the genesis of all this, go back to the actual case, we've been at this now in the public domain for 2 years. The actual set of events took place over a couple of weeks in response to Ambassador Wilson's public outing, if you will, of the administration. And it wasn't as big a deal, I believe, within the administration as everybody has made it out to be, right? The crimes rarely are as big as the cover-ups. So now we have the typical Washington situation in which all the story is about the cover-up, not about the alleged offense. In fact, if Fitzgerald is to be believed, can't make the case on the offense itself.
Well, let me ask you, you've been in the on the military side of the government, and what John, again, this John Dean article, he argues that Cheney, when he told Libby, just clearly knew that she was in a secret part of the CIA. Everyone knows that if you work on that division, it's secret. When you've been out of the country or not, whether it technically violates one law or another, you know. And as I understand it, Libby's position is he forgot that Cheney told him that, and then he claims he heard it from reporters. Doesn't that strike you as kind of an odd position to take? I mean, the vice president told you this thing, you admit that, and then you say you forgot that he told you, and your whole case hinges on that. You think some reporters told you, and then the reporters deny they told you. Do you think it's really going to be wrapped up so easily?
I have no idea. I mean, that's more of a legal issue. On the basic question, which is, what was that alleged exchange between Cheney and Scooter Libby about? I think it was somewhat different. I think what was going on here was a real concern on the part of the administration all throughout 2002, 2003, that the CIA was basically either lying to them about what they knew about Iraq or, after the fact, trying to cover their butts when it was increasingly clear that, in fact, the intelligence had been totally and completely wrong. So they, I think, looked at Wilson as being an agent of the CIA, and that his wife, in fact, was not doing Wilson's bidding, but doing her organization's bidding, and that this was all essentially arranged. So then the point being that when Cheney mentions this to Scooter, it's in the context of trying to figure out what's the link back to the cabal in the CIA, not how do we smash Wilson, who, frankly, was rather irrelevant except when he went public.
Well, just in that sense, though, I mean, you're suggesting one conspiracy theory that even people on the left would be afraid to think. You're saying there's actually a secret government that the CIA represents that was trying to undermine the president.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what the administration was concerned about, that the agency was, in fact, trying to make the issue that the president or the White House manipulated the intelligence when, in fact, by all accounts, including the Senate Intelligence Committee's own investigation, it was the agency that was manipulating the intelligence. It was the agency who ignored Wilson's own report after February of 2002, didn't factor it into any of their reports, and continued to report that the Iraqis were looking for yellow cake and nuclear materials in Africa. So if there's anybody to blame here, it's in fact the CIA, neither Wilson nor Cheney.
Well, Ed Lazarus, I don't know if you want to defend the CIA here, but in terms of the legal issues here, there is a question of the talking to the reporters. And I want to ask you a twofold question. One, do you think this is going to go to the vice president? And secondly, what about this issue of forgetting? The convenient forgetting that you heard from the vice president, you work for him, and you heard it from reporters, and then the reporters deny that they ever told you any such thing.
I think it is going to be difficult for Scooter to convince a jury, if it ever got to that, that he had a mental lapse over this. It's going to be very uncharacteristic. There's going to be testimony that makes his story sound pretty thin. That's my strong guess. Fitzgerald's a very professional prosecutor, and I don't think he would have indicted if he didn't think this was readily provable. But all that said, I think it's a mistake to focus just on the Libby scandal. That's not really what's at stake right now for the president. That's only a piece of the puzzle. We're learning more and more about Tom DeLay and the Jack Abramoff lobbyist scandal. I think during the various lulls in the Libby case, and there are going to be some substantial ones, there are going to be a lot of other scandals filling in the gaps. And I think that's really where the president's problem is going to be, that his whole party is going to come under attack. The culture of scandal in Washington is back with a vengeance.
Well, let me just say, in my unaccustomed role as the moderator here, I'm hearing things that I find quite shocking. I mean, one is the right-wing position is that the CIA and the president are involved in a full-throated war here, and your position is that the Libby troubles are rather minor compared to the attacks that are going to come on this administration for corruption and cronyism and actually violations of the law on the part of lobbyists, somebody like Abramoff, who was very closely tied in.
Well,
it seems to me that those kinds of accusations really go much more to the heart of American government than the question of whether Scooter dissembled in his testimony. I mean, you're talking about a whole system in Washington that just was awash with cash, and if the allegations that are beginning to emerge develop, it's going to turn into a tremendous quid pro quo scandal, and that's going to be a real problem for Republicans in general if the trail heads down the road much further than it's gone already.
Well, Ariane, I guess this is the right moment to bring you in. We've had a rather bleak view of what's going on in American society at this moment. Do you have a more optimistic view?
Oh, you're turning to me for optimism and faith in the American people for sure, but not in this Republican administration. I'm surprised to hear you describe it as dissembling when this was kind of pretty unambiguous lying. And one of the things that Democratic senators are coming together to do is to ask the president to give them and the American people an assurance that he will not pardon Scooter Libby. I think this is incredibly important because the fact that Libby did not try to enter into a plea agreement, the fact that he said categorically he was innocent, may all be sort of in preparation for a pre-Thanksgiving or a pre-Christmas pardon, because the last thing this administration wants is for the documents that will have to be made public in the course of a trial, the information that the nation will find out about in the course of a trial, it would be the most disastrous thing for the administration. So short of a plea agreement, which Libby now rejected, they need to be giving us a clear assurance that there will be no pardon.
Dr. Gorey, let me ask you, as a veteran of previous Republican administrations, there are some echoes here of you know, turning against you, ethical issues. Does it trouble you that this ABC poll shows that 58% of the American people doubt the president's honesty? There's never been a majority taking that view towards this president.
Oh, absolutely. I think this president is in difficulty, political difficulty. He is in electoral difficulty coming into the next election, or his party is. There's no question. This is a bad time for the president and for the Republican Party. And frankly, there's some justification. How much we'll see with respect to delay, how much we'll see with respect to some of the other cases that are being pursued. But on the other hand, let's also remember that after 2+ years of chasing down the Wilson Plame case, frankly, I think that the special prosecutor came up with a pigeon's egg. He got one individual who was not accused of the underlying crime. He is alleged he's going after Rove still, but again, most experts don't think that he's going to actually do anything. So unless there's something that Scooter's expected to do in the way of flipping on Rove, the president, the vice president, this thing has dead-ended without much.
Well, I must say, I really disagree with that assessment. I mean, even if you open any newspaper today, you see just how tangled up everybody was. We have a story in the New York Times by Doug Gell about a former aide to Cheney, Eric Edelman, who is now the Defense Department. He was somebody named only by job description in the indictment as having been part of the conversations Libby had held. We have the new chief of staff to the vice president, David Addington, who was also named by job title only, John Hanna, who is in the vice president's office. So the same people, it appears, who were in the indictment, perhaps not by name but by job description, are still very much the people around Cheney, the people in the Defense Department. So this is not just about Libby lying. This is, as we've said before, about the lies and deceptions and the cover-ups that led us to war.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Up ahead, Judge Alito's nomination and the attack of the killer Democrats. But first, you're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Find more Left, Right, and Center programs and podcasts at kcrw.com.
Welcome back to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Robert Scheer, sitting in as moderator today with Arianna Huffington, along with guest centrist Edward Lazarus, and in Washington on the right, our guest Dr. Daniel Gore. Let's move now on to the nomination of Judge Samuel Alito. Ed, you've been a follower of the Supreme Court. You worked in the Supreme Court as a clerk. Is this guy, do you think he's good? Is there going to be much controversy?
I think we can discern three things about Alito right off the bat. Number one, he's very, very smart and well-credentialed. Number two, by all accounts, he's a very decent guy, buys pizza for the people who work for him. And number three, he's extremely conservative. Whether you look at the issues of women's rights, the right to privacy more generally, workers' rights, civil rights, the power of government over individuals in the criminal law, the powers of Congress to institute laws. I mean, here's someone who thought that the federal statute that criminalizes the possession of machine guns was unconstitutional. He's pretty far out there on the right wing. And so the question is a political one. The Democrats are not going to have enough votes to defeat him on an up or down vote on the floor of the Senate. So the question is whether they're going to mount a filibuster. And I think the verdict is out on that. And it will depend on how he does at his hearings and just how extreme some of his opinions appear.
Let me ask you a question. I got in some trouble writing a column saying that Harriet Myers might not be the worst person on the court and that I thought she was being treated somewhat unfairly. Are you telling me that Alito is more consistently conservative, more right-wing?
Oh, he's much more right-wing than John Roberts, in my view, based on what you can see from the record. More conservative than William Rehnquist, in all likelihood. He's got a case, a privacy case, that he wrote where he was to the right of Michael Chertoff, the Homeland Security head right now. He's very far to the right on the spectrum. But that's the question. The conservatives have an agenda in the law. He is one of the most skilled advocates of that agenda. And it's a question of whether Democrats want, on the basis of ideology, not credentials, to attack this person.
You know, before I get our other guests in, I just want to ask you, the L.A. Times had a piece, Henry Weinstein, a very esteemed commentator on the court and a lawyer himself, saying that he interviewed clerks who had worked with him. You've been a law clerk. And presented a contrarian view, saying this guy is really more moderate, more reasonable than is being suggested. Is that?
I think this is just what happens. It comes with the territory. Former clerks are extremely loyal. They know that the best thing to say about Alito is that he's moderate. I'm sure he is in his personal life, not someone who's – he's not like Scalia in that he's not so barbed and sarcastic as Scalia is, and so I think the Scalito nickname isn't very apt. He's someone who's very collegial, but that doesn't change the written record of 15 years on the bench, and you read his opinions, and while there's the occasional liberal aberration, the great run of them are very conservative.
And Daniel Gore, do you think that's a good thing, and is it true? Is he more conservative than the other men mentioned? Is he another Scalia?
I don't think there's any reason not to believe that, in essence, he is a conservative. Whether I would agree with moderate or leftists trying to pin him on the conservative or right-wing spectrum, I don't know. I find it interesting that that's what tends to happen. The other side tends to tell you where you sit rather than your own side. But I think it's quite clear that your basic point is right, that you had a chance with Harriet Myers, or the president offered up a moderate, and got slammed for it, certainly on his own side, and came back with somebody that is close to, if not absolutely fitting the bill, of the person he promised to appoint when he ran for re-election. And you're getting what you paid for, so to speak.
You know, I can't tell you how grateful I am that you're endorsing my Harriet Myers as a moderate person, because not one single human being has supported me in this position. Can you tell me why I was right?
Well, I think if you look at her, she was more flexible. She did not have a doctrine, if you will, that she had, at least there's no evidence of it, that she had spent time thinking about, had become committed to, had fought out with law clerks, other judges in the public domain. And so at the very least, she was, shall we say, somewhat malleable in her judicial thinking. She also came from a different part of the judicial community where, you know, as a lawyer and in the kind of chief of staff position, you compromise a lot, you work things out, not the way you'd operate as a senior judge or as a Supreme Court justice.
Arianna, let me get you into this. You were very harsh on Harriet Myers, and now we have another another Catholic male. Wasn't there something good about this woman? She'd battled against male dominance. She had some independence. Do you have any regrets at all of being so successful in destroying her?
Actually, I have no regrets, and nor was I one of those who devoted a lot of time in destroying her. I think the conservative right did that. But what I'm really concerned about it now is to have a debate when it comes to Judge Alito that is beyond abortion. I mean, abortion is obviously a critical issue, but there are so many other issues involved. And where he stands on civil rights, where he stands on civil liberties, including where he stands on guns. I mean, we need to sort of take a larger view so that this is not seen just as a cultural battle, which the Republicans would love, of course, purely based on abortion. But it is going to be a battle. There is no question that since the Democrats don't have the votes to defeat him, if it requires a filibuster and the Republicans retaliate with the nuclear option, all that is going to happen in a way which may consume all the oxygen from the other issues Democrats have done a better job this week of addressing, like the war, like how we got there and how we're going to get out.
Let me ask you a question, and maybe it's impolite, all three, and if you can give me just a brief answer. In the last presidential election, the Pope weighed in, the Catholic Church weighed in, and Kerry and cardinals denied him communion and so forth. We now have a situation where yet another Catholic is being nominated. Is it legitimate to ask, you know, the old question that the founders might ask, because they were very suspicious of the papacy, a good number of them, what is the role of – what does it mean to be a Catholic and yet be a judge? And are your positions on critical questions of, say, gay rights or right of a woman to choose, are they determined by the church? And Dr. Gore, you said people are pinning labels, but isn't this a legitimate area of inquiry?
No, I think it's a very legitimate question, and it probably ought to be raised. Now, you know, let's be careful that we then ought to be raising similar questions about other social or religious affiliations for any of our justices, and you know, we have to be at least for a moment concerned about where that leads.
Well, but let me just interrupt. But when you say others, but the Catholic Church has taken a very aggressive position of saying if you're a Catholic, you're supposed to believe certain things. I don't believe mainline Methodists are taking that position.
Well, but for example, so has the ACLU, which would have done real damage to another Supreme Court nominee who's now sitting on the court. So again, if you want to go down this road, then it ought to be an open shot for any of those associations, and you know, that could be quite a food fight.
You know, William Brennan, the leading liberal of the 20th century, was also Catholic, so I think you can carry this too far. I think the real regrettable thing was in the Myers nomination that the president made religious belief a qualification for the Supreme Court, and that really violated the truce that was declared in 1960 at the latest when Jack Kennedy ran for office. And that was an unfortunate injection of religion into this debate.
Yes, but this candidate has injected religion or religions there because he's taken the position he did yesterday with on Thursday with two senators said they came out of the meeting with him and he said he thinks there's been too tough a wall of separating church and state. So that's come up already. You can't duck it. Now, Arianna, you're committed to a spirituality, a sensibility here. Is there any of this concern you? A final comment.
You know, what concerns me is that we're going to have to wait now until January, which is legitimate because there are a lot of documents to wade through. But it's going to be January before we actually hear from Alito. And in the meantime, we're going to hear from everybody else, including his 90-year-old mother, who's already weighed in and told us, of course, he's against abortion. I wonder how long it's going to be before we have some information in the National Enquirer or the Star about him. Between now and January, it's an eternity.
Much as I'd like to keep going, we got to move on. But Arianna, I just want to stick with you here because you've been begging the Democrats to find their whatever they are, let's say backbone. Have they found it in the Senate?
Well, this was a very exciting week. It was very exciting to see Harry Reid actually take extraordinary measures and succeeding. You know, he managed to change the debate. He managed to get every cable show and the front pages of every paper the next day focusing on the need for this administration to come clean on whether they had manipulated pre-war intelligence to get us to war, a report which was due, which they have been delaying. And this measure put the spotlight on it again. Now the question is, can they stay on this or are they going to retreat? And take another few weeks or months before they come back with something bold and decisive.
Dr. Gore, have they been bold and decisive?
Nah, they were playing old, boring stuff. There was a report written by the as political theater, it works. Can they stick on it? No, because in fact, it has no substance. There's no good script here. The Senate did a report, 500 plus pages. Conclusion 82 in that report. Anybody read it? I have. Says that there was no evidence of any manipulation of intelligence by the administration. The real story here, which the Democrats can't touch for some reason, is that our intelligence was, going way, way back with Saddam and everybody else, lousy. It was lousy in the Clinton administration. It continues to be lousy. And that is a national security crisis, which for some reason the Democrats don't want to jump on.
Okay, but you know, even though I'm moderate, I did read the report. And first of all, we were promised a second report. The first report only dealt with sort of lower level officials. The second report was supposed to deal with what was the role basically of the White House, the people in charge. We haven't gotten that second report. But the other thing that bothers me about this is that we didn't know. How come Hans Blix knew? How come the UN knew? How come, you know, all these people around the world who criticized us knew?
They didn't know. Well, the French government, the German government, they all had the same intelligence. They were all giving us the same bad story.
Yeah,
everybody
was giving the story
to each other.
Well, one could have waited for the UN to do its work for another 3 months. Ed, do you have a last word on this?
No, I don't. I actually think that the second report is not going to say anything very earth-shattering, and that it really was political theater. But I enjoyed it as political theater because I'm so used to the Republicans doing it so much better than the Democrats.
Ariana?
Well, just very quickly, there are two separate issues. One is that it is true that the U.S. intelligence got it wrong, and these were honest mistakes, as Jonathan Jade said in the L.A. Times on Friday. But it is equally true that there was manipulation from above, and sexed up intelligence, and that's
There's no evidence of that.
This is a good moment to begin our famed left, right, and center rant. And so, Dr. Gore, you can rant on this or any other subject for 15 seconds.
Well, I really think that the issue here is that while focusing on the White House, we are missing the big issue in intelligence, which is, in fact, that it's bad and getting worse. We don't have the human. We don't have the speakers of Arabic and other languages. And as a result, the risk of another 9/11 is still quite high.
Ed, you want to rant?
I'll just pick up on something Ariana said, which is that I hope the debate over Sam Alito is not a debate over the right to abortion. Roe versus Wade is going to stand for the foreseeable future. The Republicans like having being one vote away all the time. Let's have a debate on the other big constitutional issues, and let's have it in January.
Ariana?
I just want to read from this column by Jonathan Chade just to counter the idea that everybody agreed that there were weapons of mass destruction. Here's what he says. The Clintonites warned against Hussein's weapons, but they didn't bully intelligence analysts into suppressing contrary information. They didn't pass on information they knew was false. That's the difference, and that's what the second report will be about.
And they didn't find these weapons of mass destruction, I have to point out. But that's all the time we have for Deception today. Thanks to our special guests, Edward Lazarus and Dr. Daniel Gore and Ariana Huffington, as usual. Our producer is Sarah Spitz. The technical director is Ray Guana, with engineering assistance from David Green. I'm Robert Scheer. Thanks for listening. Matt Miller and Tony Blankley return next week, so join us then for another lively edition of Left, Right, and Center.
Oh, so if you like pajamas, I'll wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
Well, we know we need each other, so we better call the calling of all.
Audio archives and podcasts of KCRW programs are at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about Left, Right, and Center, email lrc@kcrw.com. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by 89.9 KCRW Santa Monica and kcrw.com.
You've been listening to KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Le Show, a weekly romp through the worlds of media, politics, sports, and show business with satirist Harry Shearer. Check out the podcast of Le Show at kcrw.com.